We are talking about £87 billion of assets. We are talking about a really substantial sum of money.
It's easy to say the nonprofit sector is broken. Less easy is saying how we're going to fix it. Welcome to What Donors Want, a podcast by IG Advisors, where we speak with brilliant people to reimagine the future of social impact. In this fourth season, we'll be switching things up a bit and diving into what we all want, including and beyond donors. I'm Rachel Stephenson-Scheff, IG's Managing Director, and we're a strategy consultancy specializing in social and environmental change. This podcast is part of our mission to fix the flow of resources for good. Welcome back to What Donors Want. I'm Rachel, IG's Managing Director.
And I'm Emily, IG's CEO.
And today we're exploring the concept of mandatory foundation payouts in the UK.
We have three brilliant minds joining us today, bringing viewpoints from a media, think tank, and research perspective.
Before we dive in, want to send a thank you and shout out to our official season four sponsor, Siegel Family Foundation. And also a thank you to our fantastic media partner, Alliance Magazine. And of course, a particular shout out to one of our guests today, Charles Keaton, who's their editor and who graciously brought us together for this conversation. You can check out their website, alliancemagazine.org, and get 50% off a subscription with the code WHATDONORSWANT, all one word, at checkout. All right, on to the conversation. Hope you enjoy it. Welcome, Charles, Rodri, and Nicole to What Donors Want. We're so thrilled to be able to sit down with you today and dive into this. So before we get into the conversation, can I just ask you to start by introducing yourself to listeners? Who are you? Where do you work? What kind of organizations are you affiliated with? And where are you coming to this conversation from?
Sure. Hi, Rachel, and thanks for having me on. I'm Charles Keaton. I'm executive editor of Alliance Magazine, which covers what's happening in philanthropy around the world. I'm actually a foundation director turned philanthropy editor, having once, over a decade ago now, actually run a charitable foundation, now looking at it from the other point of view.
I'm Rodri Davis. So I'm the founder and director of Why Philanthropy Matters, which is a newish think tank that sort of focuses on trying to put philanthropy in context. I'm also a research fellow at the Centre for Philanthropy at the University of Kent, and I am the philanthropy expert in residence at the Pairs Foundation as well.
I'm Nicole Sykes. I'm the director of policy communications at Pro Bono Economics. We are a charity and a think tank dedicated to ending low personal well-being in the UK. So particularly focused around people who are unhappy, dissatisfied, and anxious. And one of the key things we look at is how the social sector can be improved in order to unlock that and make a difference. So working around charities, social enterprises, community groups, civil society more broadly.
Thanks all so much. I feel like we have a really good group. I don't think there's a better group to have this conversation with. So thrilled to do this. So, of course, we're here today to talk about mandatory foundation payouts, and particularly across Europe and the UK. So I'm wondering if you can help us set the context or set the scene for this a little bit. Why are we talking about this? And why now? What's happened recently? And why is this an important conversation that we should be having?
So here at PBE, we recently did some research looking into foundations, and it did spark a little bit of a debate. But obviously, it's a conversation that Charles and others have been having for a very, very long time. But we did some research looking at foundations. We looked at about a sample of about 2,000 grant-making trusts and foundations in England and Wales, examining the level of expenditure that they were doing against their net asset levels. And around those that we could identify, we found about 130 organisations that were distributing less than 3% of their net assets on average over that period. And we kind of pointed this out and looked and figured out that if those grant-making trusts and foundations raised their charitable expenditure levels to just 3% of their net assets, it would have generated an extra £300 million for good causes each year. And so that's obviously just looking at a sample of 2,000 of these organisations. Not all of those organisations actually report all of their information. So there's that. And looking at 2,000 organisations, that's probably just somewhere between a quarter and a fifth of all foundations that are registered in the UK. So we were looking at a small group and still finding that you could generate a substantial amount of income if they raised their giving levels up. So I think that that piece of research generated a lot of debate and discussion, perhaps particularly because it is set against such a difficult state that the charity sector is in right now. And, you know, we are in this era of perma-crisis. We are in an era of growing wealth inequality. So the idea of foundations, we called them sort of hidden dragons, these kind of hidden away foundations that were sitting on a lot of money and not paying it out, in the context of so much need and so many different things going on in society and such growing wealth inequality, I think that helped spark and lay some of the context for why we're talking about it.
I was just going to pick up on that and just, I mean, echo a bit what Nicole said. I was trying to think in kind of preparing for this, why it is that we're talking about all of this now, because the question of whether foundations should pay out more and just the general frustration at the idea that these things are there and have all this money and not enough of it is getting out, it's been around for forever. I think there is certainly something about the sense of urgency at the moment, because the scale of the problems that we're facing, both kind of economically in terms of the cost of living crisis, but also around climate and other issues, the sense that, you know, if there's money there potentially on the table or that could be on the table and isn't, that's a huge source of frustration. I think that's the kind of pragmatic bit. And then there are still those kind of deeper underlying theoretical concerns that have always been there about whether foundations represent a kind of unwholesome concentration of power. And so actually part of the desire to break them open and get the money out there more is the sort of sense of, you know, if this is supposed to be partly redistributive and the money's just sitting there in these endowments with little bits of it trickling out, but it's still controlled by the people who made the wealth in the first place, philanthropy's not really quite doing the job that we want it to. So I think that's a big part of the conversation as well, particularly with all the focus at the moment on concerns about justice and sort of decolonizing wealth and philanthropy as well.
Yeah, I'd agree with all that. And I think that explains why in this context, what Nicole and Roger are saying is why there's a conversation happening now. Just to give you some kind of financial context, according to the Alliance research we've done for the 2022 figures, minimum 5% payouts in line with what there is currently in the US and Canada would lead up to an extra £1.8 billion going to the charity sector. At 3%, we calculated at £620 million. So that's twice the figure Nicole's citing, but we're including in our analysis the giant Wellcome Trust, whose assets have grown by, I think, £8.5 billion between 2021 and 2022. And their payout has gone down to just over 2% from 2.7%. So why are these giant foundations, in some cases giant foundation, in other cases smaller ones, but foundations across the spectrum with huge assets paying out a relatively small amount to charity? A mandatory payout would generate a huge amount more giving to charity at a time when there's social need. But actually, giving charity is only about addressing welfare concerns. It's also about associational life and the health of wider civil society. Democracy is in crisis. Foundations could fund public interest campaigners, lawyers, journalists, as well as our classic kind of social welfare issues. And instead, what we have is a position where the rate of giving is not keeping up with the growth in assets that we're seeing based on the analysis that Nicole was citing and that we found. And that raises a question why, and whether encouragement and incentives are, yes, necessary, but not really sufficient. And there's models in other countries of how actually it can be done differently. And I think that's what certainly sparked the thinking on my side, as someone who actually used to work in one of these foundations and now seeing the potential for them to do far more good than they currently do.
Thanks for sharing all that. I think it's such a good point. And it is so, there's such a particular pain with this because, as you say, the assets are there, the money is there. This isn't about raising more money and thinking about fundraisers who are listening, who are, you know, every fundraiser we work with is scrambling to get more resources in the door for their cause, to build the market for their cause, to influence donors and philanthropy flows towards their work. And what we're saying here, if, you know, if we're explaining it in extremely simple terms to someone listening who might not be familiar with this regulation, but correct me if I'm wrong, what we're saying is that there are these assets, there is money being held in different vehicles, that has already been earmarked as philanthropic resources, foundation assets, et cetera, but it's just not being spent. It's just sitting there. And there is no mandatory requirement for them to pay a minimum amount of those assets every year, whereas, as you say, Charles, in the US and Canada, there is the minimum 5% annual threshold. But without that, and you know, some might even argue 5% isn't enough. So that's, there's a lot of nuance around that. But what we're really saying is there are these assets that are supposed to be used for philanthropy, and they are not being used. They are sitting there, and we're in a moment of permacrisis, where that is a very painful reality to reckon with for many people.
Yeah. And just to put those assets in context, you know, we are talking about £87 billion of assets. We are talking about a really substantial sum of money.
Yeah. Wow. So drilling down specifically onto this kind of mandatory payout, so that's kind of the stick rather than the carrot of why you should be spending this money now. What's the public policy kind of role and purpose of mandatory payouts? Obviously, we're talking about getting more money out into civil society as a kind of understood good in what we're talking about here. But what role does the kind of regulation or the kind of making it mandatory play in the philanthropy ecosystem in which it's put in place?
I guess the mention of mandatory highlights one of the issues here, which, well, there's two. There's a theoretical one and a sort of practical one. The theoretical one is a concern that in mandating a certain level of payout, you're undermining what in some people's view is the kind of fundamental freedom that comes along with philanthropy, you know, the freedom for the donor or the individual themselves or through an institution to choose when and how to give and how much. I think obviously the complicating factor with that when you're talking about foundations and tax-advantaged philanthropy is it's not just the donor themselves in isolation deciding what to do. They are getting benefits for their giving, and actually, arguably, all of the rest of us as citizens are sort of chipping in through the tax system. So we all do have a stake. So I think, you know, I'm not sure I buy the argument that it's a kind of unjustified attack on liberty. I mean, the one thing that I think is difficult in this conversation when we're talking from a UK point of view is there are quite significant disanalogies between the situation in the US and the UK, the most fundamental of which is we talk about foundations as if we all know what we're talking about. We don't actually have a legal definition or a structure for foundations in the UK. And without that, it's quite difficult to mandate a level of expenditure only for that type of organization, because actually we don't have any way of drawing defined boundaries around it. So if we just brought in a mandatory payout at the moment, it would have to apply to presumably all registered charities or those that have endowments. Now, obviously, that's not an insurmountable problem, but in a practical sense, the bit that we might need to do first is deciding, well, how would we stipulate what is or isn't a foundation and what it is that we're actually focusing on from a policy point of view? And that is a reasonably big pragmatic challenge, I think.
Well, and the good news here is, and thanks in part to the PEZ Foundation, we now have the Family Foundation Giving Trends, which is now published by the Association of Charitable Foundations, and they help us with disaggregating different types of foundation. And we can look at family foundations, for example, we can look at community foundations, and we can identify how they might differ from public fundraising charities as they do in the US. So I think there is policy work that could be done to exactly do this. I think it's more a question of the will to do it. And here at the US example is actually instructive, because there, you mentioned about donor freedom. Not even the most kind of libertarian philanthropy group in the US, the Philanthropy Roundtable, is suggesting that the 5% payout that exists there should be reduced or removed. They're just trying to defend the status quo against calls for the payout to be extended to 10% and extended to donor advised funds and community foundations. So while there is sometimes a suggestion that in the US there's a very pro-philanthropy climate, and I would say that is correct, but that hasn't stopped them from having these more robust debates about levels of spending or lack of it from foundations. And I do think that the stakes are high and there is resource on the table. I'd also say that actually, contrary to what you're saying, Emily, it doesn't have to be a stick. I think mandating a distribution quota, as they're known in the Canadian context, or payout, could actually be a carrot. Because what it is, according to the Australian scholar Christian Siebert, is an opportunity that he sees in his country where it's actually a social contract. And it helps actually maintain a contract between the donor community and the donor class and the wider society, demonstrating that while these assets may exist for a longer term or even in perpetuity with a 5% payout, it actually demonstrates in tangible terms that there is resources being contributed back to society. And that really does raise the question about what the purpose is. Like some people rightly, I think, raise concerns that payouts could lead to the premature loss of foundations which otherwise would exist in perpetuity. But actually, that's more debate about the level at which payouts are set rather than whether they should exist in the first place. So at a level of between 3 and 5%, you can unlock lots of extra millions for people in need in our country, but also allow foundations that so choose to continue to exist for the long term. So I think there's a real argument to be looking at what's been happening in the US, Canada, Australia. And also, I would say, to challenge some of the kind of, I would say, not particularly sophisticated thinking that's been coming out of some of the speeches from the Charity Commission and the Culture Secretary recently, which is really talking about actually making a more permissive environment for foundations and really just switching to a kind of, I would say, a default mode of gratitude rather than scrutiny. Whereas actually, I think we need scrutiny at the moment to understand where the opportunities are, because there's so much need.
You mentioned a few different things in this conversation around why a foundation might not want to pay out 3% or 5% or whatever. So we've heard kind of control, we've heard the protecting the perpetuity. Are there any other kind of reasons that you're hearing from people who are kind of having a reaction to this case? What are the reasons that staff or leaders or trustees in a UK foundation wouldn't want to pay out 3% a year?
Yeah, and I think some of those have been covered already, and certainly the idea of challenging the independence of the trustees who are in charge felt like a big emotive reaction to the research that we published. But as Rotary said, this is money that has been given very generous tax relief because it is meant to be spent on public good and charitable causes. I think the other big bit of pushback we had was, while we've just come out of COVID, we're in a cost of living crisis. Foundations need to have the flexibility to be able to respond in more generous terms at certain times. And also at the same time, might want to, you know, make very large donations at one point in a 5-year period, for example, a big capital investment, for example, and then go back to kind of restoring the endowment, for example. And I guess related to that, the idea that a mandatory threshold would be a ceiling rather than a floor. Now I should say PBE doesn't have a strong policy position yet. We're still sort of in consultation as to which way we think it should go. But in doing so, I think there's a couple of things that are really important. One part of that is that you can build flexibility into a threshold system, and Canada has that, for example. The threshold is set over like an 8-quarter period in order to allow some spending that is bigger in other years and some in others. And I think the other point that's really important to address is, at the end of the day, what we are talking about are foundations who are not giving appropriately. And some of the examples that we found were actually really, really shocking. You know, there was one foundation with something like £1.5 million in assets, so not the hugest, but it was making grants of just £5,600 a year on, you know, one annual scholarship for one student at one university that the founder of the foundation had gone to. And you've really got to ask if that is the right use of that money. You know, and you read some of these accounts, you know, there was one foundation which had £500 million in assets, so really quite substantial. And you read the accounts, and the objective for the trustees is to grow the endowment. You know, you're already one of the largest foundations out there. How much more do you want it to grow? And actually, that charity had spent £3 million managing their assets and only £2 million in grants to charities. Is your objective really set right at this point in time? And I think that is a really interesting nuance that you also want to address when it comes to setting regulation, setting policy about something like a mandatory threshold, because it's not just how much money are you spending on grants, but it's also, you know, how does that balance against the expenditure you are making on managing the money that is there?
Those are such interesting examples. Thank you for bringing that to life. It does beg the question of perpetuity is often a goal. You know, if you exist in perpetuity, then surely you can create impact in perpetuity. That's the assumption. But of course, even the climate crisis begs to differ. Does perpetuity even exist And if, you know, I think that's a very obvious cause where it can challenge that kind of long-term thinking. It's really quite interesting. And there's also something, I know it's a different context, but in the US where there are these mandatory payouts, but as you mentioned earlier, the DAFs are a loophole and there's a lot of assets sitting in DAFs that are not being used. And I've had lots of conversations with people, donors and DAFs in the States, who are also talking about the anxiety of people wanting to get it right and how much a lengthy strategic planning and thinking processes
and
that
staff capacity
and staff capacity that organizations are going through, or they're putting money in a DAF and they want to address it towards the end of their life when they're handing it over to their children. But, you know, there is a desire to do right by those assets later on, but it's a problem for not now. And then it creates so much tension in the interim.
One thing I was going to say on that is, I think in terms of the arguments against payout, just coming back to that, one of them is partly because there is a bit of a conflation of the debate about payouts and mandatory payouts and the whole debate about spending down in perpetuity. Because I think actually they don't need, I mean, they're linked, obviously, and they're kind of driven by similar things. But I think there's sometimes people extrapolate from, well, we're talking about mandatory payouts to, oh, you're forcing us to spend down and we won't exist at this point in the future. Whereas actually most of the conversation about payout rates wouldn't result in most organizations disappearing. It would just mean that they were spending slightly more money in grants every year. So I think the two things, it's useful to separate the two. I think the other thing to say is that it's useful to link the conversation about payouts back up with the conversation about how foundation assets are invested. Because again, the other thing is, if you're talking just about how money is given out in grants, you almost play into that sort of trope where you just invested the money in whatever way you wanted to try and get the best possible financial return. And then you thought about doing good with it by giving it away. Whereas actually, I think there is an argument that, you know, we should maybe up the rate at which organizations need to give away in grants, but we also need to think about how they're investing those assets so that they're actually, at the very least, not doing harm in the world and hopefully doing some positive social good. So I think linking those two debates up more would be helpful. I guess the final thing I just wanted to say in terms of, you know, doing justice to people who might argue against payouts, I think it's fair to say, in the UK context, I'm aware one of the arguments people would put forward as to why we don't particularly need it is that our system sort of works fairly fundamentally different to the US, in that over there, it's obviously a tax jurisdiction, it's policed by the IRS, and therefore it's a rules-based system. They need to stipulate a rule like the mandatory payout requirement. Over here, we have, you know, a public benefit test, we have charitable status, we have a standalone regulatory authority in the Charity Commission. So, and this is not necessarily my point of view, but I'm trying to sort of convey it, people would argue that actually we have more of a sort of principles-based approach, and therefore there are things that drive foundations to have to distribute that money for public good. Now, obviously, the fly in the ointment there is, you know, as the research that Nicole's done and also that Charles has done, it doesn't seem as though that is actually being that effective in terms of getting large volumes of money out there. But that certainly is one of the pushbacks that you will get if you get into this debate with anyone.
This podcast is made possible by Siegel Family Foundation. We are building an extensive network of extraordinary people positively transforming lives and communities across Africa. Whether you're a dreamer, funder, leader, or visionary, our network can help you make the greatest impact. To learn more, visit www.siegelfamilyfoundation.org or contact us at info@siegelfamilyfoundation.org.
The charity regulator is one of the smallest regulators that we have in the UK, and yet is expected to regulate 160,000 organisations, 180,000 organisations. They are incredibly limited on what they can do. When I would make the argument that if you have a very large amount of capital or assets sitting there and you're not distributing it to a substantial degree, you may not be fulfilling the charitable purposes that we would expect you to be doing so. And the Charity Commission at the moment is only resourced to intervene if you're not spending anything over a 5-year period. Now, that is a very long time, firstly, particularly in our current context. But it's also, and when if someone is spending almost nothing, or indeed actually nothing, the Charity Commission can spend it, send them off to this revitalizing trust guidance. They may do some one-on-one support, but it's really a team of, I think at max, three human beings. And that might be being generous in terms of their resources. So all they can act on are these organizations which are doing nothing. And actually, you might say you would be much better spent intervening with organizations that were at least trying to do something, because at least then there are activities there and there are trustees that are interested and maybe there's some help out there that they're already connected to, but they are not quite utilizing and putting forwards to actually, you know, take them from 1% to 3%. Even without going through regulation and defining foundations and legislation and all the rest, just encouraging more resource in the Charity Commission to actually use the powers it has and the expertise that it has to go out there and say, you're not meeting your charitable objectives by doing really not much, guys. How can we turn that around? And trustees do sit up when a regulator gets involved.
That sounds sensible, but I don't think it's any substitute for compulsion. And I think compulsion, while it would be resisted by many in the kind of status quo, for status who are defenders of the status quo, actually I think it would ultimately do them a favor, because what I'm talking about, I think at its essence, is legitimacy of philanthropy in this country and philanthropic foundations and their ability to be and to be seen to be responding to the needs that the times demand. And at the moment, I think there's open questions. So just take a couple of examples, just looking at the figures, just to give it that kind of concrete context. So Joseph Rowntree Foundation, a very impressive organization in many ways, doing some really thoughtful work on encouraging new thinking about philanthropy. But if you look at its payout, it's 1.08%, almost 450 million in assets, but only spending 4.82 million. Or the Garfield Western Foundation, known for supporting bread and butter charities across the country, 96 million in spending, but assets of almost 10 billion. So again, less than 1% payout. Welcome Trust, 2% payout, 36 billion in assets, 739 in spending. So you can imagine the Wellcome Trust doubling their spending if there was that compulsion there. And I think I agree with you, Roger, about investments and talking and thinking about how investments are directed, because ultimately, or essentially, I think most investments are on the global capital markets. They're highly paid investment managers, in some cases working in charities, some cases outside, who are paid to maximize the size of the endowment. And that is money going into the capital markets, hedge funds, private equity and other business, and not into the social infrastructure of the UK. And I just think we have the balance wrong. And we're not talking about completely tipping on its head. What we're talking about is actually just introducing a measure, quite a conservative measure in a way, 3 to 5%, that would unlock resources but still allow foundations to exist in perpetuity. And I think it's about getting the kind of the regulatory framework and our political classes really catching up with this, rather than simply saying, as the message seems to be from the culture secretary, oh, we just need to thank donors more and be more thankful for their donations, and then that will lead to greater giving. Yes, gratitude is appropriate to donors that are generous, and yes, match funding schemes, community-based funding is important. I think some of the ideas Nicole has suggested, like increasing resourcing of the Charity Commission to help maybe have a slightly less permissive regime, I think that would be welcome. But I don't think it's bold enough. And I think organizations like Pro Bono Economics are looking at this. I think it's really welcome that they've done the research they have. But where are others? New Philanthropy Capital, for example, they've really pulled their punches on this issue for fear, perhaps, of not wanting to upset some of the donors that they work with. And that is part of the challenge of being both a consultancy and a think tank. But at the same time, if you're being commissioned to do research, it makes it much harder to actually maybe have a more objective analysis. So I think that is part of the challenge in terms of the kind of nature of the debate. Of course, everyone has their own biases and their own preferences. And that's why you need a media that's scrutinizing this. And what I found interesting was the Financial Times public policy editor, when they ran a story on this, I think it was last year, he said, Peter Foster, he said he was very struck by the kind of allergic reaction in the sector and the sector bodies to any suggestion of change. And that is because foundations and donors don't like being told what to do. They want that freedom and recognize that philanthropy is about freedom. It's about private expressions of contributions to the public good, but it's also got that public element. And I think that's why payouts are, you know, is an interesting moment to be talking about this. And I hope across Europe as well, where the data really isn't good enough. So we can't quite have the debates in the European context that we can have in the UK one. But I think that perhaps that might change as well.
I think if I may just kind of state my opinion on the kind of freedoms point, I think that the withdrawal of supreme freedom to decide precisely how much money you're spending is one thing, but I think we shouldn't allow ourselves to speak in such general terms about the idea of freedom being removed overall. There's so much that you can do with that money, right? It's not a punishment of being forced to spend money on something in particular. It's just kind of looking for a balance in that regard. But there's still so much freedom and so much ultimate choice about where you can actually use that money and how you can use it. So we've mentioned a few different levels. We've mentioned 3%, 5%, 10%. There's a few kind of different figures being bandied around. How should we determine the level at which mandatory payouts exist?
I think you have to think about it in the context of the purpose. And I think the purpose here is to allow donors the freedom to make choices about how they spend and where they spend, but at the same time constrain and balance those choices with the public notion of what they're doing and the public responsibility and requirement. And it's in that context that I think you can come up with a proposition on the issue of payouts. But one point that I do think is a fair point that defenders of the status quo position have, and that is the concern that sometimes it's foundations, often the better foundations, the more professionally staffed foundations, who are maybe unfairly targeted when there's lots of wealthy people that are hoarding wealth that haven't set up foundations in the first place and aren't philanthropic. And the suggestion is that actually they're the people you should focus on to boost philanthropy, not the foundations that are committed. But you know, that's where I think public policy around wealth taxes comes in. You know, if people are wealthy and they're not giving, there's opportunities for policy measures to be considered then. I don't think that's the binary choice, but I do recognize that the foundation form is something to be protected. And in some ways, it is more transparent than donor advised funds and other vehicles. So we don't want to undercut the value that foundations play, but I don't think the proposal of a payout would do that. But I'd be interested in other views on that.
I mean, I guess in terms of picking a number for the rate, that's always a challenge. I mean, my experience of previously working in a think tank is it usually happens just before you're about to launch a report when somebody has to get out the back of a, you know, fag packet and decide what the figure is. I mean, in practical terms, I think if you're going to do it, there's a couple of ways you could go. You could take some sort of historical precedent, and the obvious one there is the kind of 10% that culturally you find across lots of different religions and actually sort of culturally elsewhere and has been replicated in things like the effective altruism movements, giving what we can initiative. And 10% just has a kind of quite a neat ring to it. You know, it's tithing, it's a tenth of what you have. I think it's probably a pretty high bar in terms of actually getting that implemented practically. So if you were looking for something a little bit less ambitious or more sort of small C conservative, I mean, the two other options would be to do a bit as we've been doing here and to look for international comparison. So we look to the US, but we might also look to Canada where the rate's slightly lower. We could look to Australia where the rate's comparable to that in the US and see whether those models work for us. Or we could also try and be as pragmatic as possible and say, well, you know, what is a level at which foundations that are currently doing what we might consider a relatively good job are giving at? And then essentially say, we're not saying anything other than everyone else just needs to come up to that level. So let's pick a level that looks like best practice now and just try and draw everybody up to that rather than trying to sort of look like we're being very normative and imposing something that currently nobody is achieving. But which of those works, again, probably comes down to political horse trading and realpolitik. You just have to think what would be most likely to be saleable if you were genuinely focused on trying to get this through as a policy proposal.
I mean, I think it's worth saying that it's perfectly modelable. Like the data is not perfect on this stuff. It's actually, well, it's pretty rubbish. But I think you could certainly model what that might look like under a range of scenarios. You could also do things like phase it in, you know, and assess what's happening as you phase a policy in. But I do think it's worth pointing to actually some of the Canadian research, I think, was that when they did have it set at a higher level, I believe they were seeing some more premature foundation death and some adverse circumstances. So they revised what they do. And that's what you do. If a policy isn't going the way that you want it to, you keep it evaluated and you adjust it as you need to go. So I think that's worth bearing in mind. I think also, as we discuss like how you can build flexibility into a proposal like that, because I think the flexibility element is important, I am struck by there is perhaps something of a trade-off in terms of the investment conversation that Rodri was having and potentially the threshold level. Just because if you are doing those more like impactful investments, they are perhaps a little bit riskier, and they do take longer for the returns to come in. So perhaps starting with a lower level and encouraging investment at the same time, you know, you might get more carrots along the way and more support to bring a foundation sector on the right journey on both of those elements of paying out and investing more in a socially impactful way. Because both of those things are quite hard to do. You know, it would take time to bring in legislation, et cetera, and it's a challenge, but certainly an overcomable one. But the shifting the investment map is clearly something that there are, you know, numerous challenges around for trustees.
That's really useful. Thank you for sharing all that. I think this is such a sensible conversation, which I really, really appreciate. So much of what you've shared is just so sensible. It's so tangible as well, and so flexible. Even what you were saying there in the policy solution, being iterative and flexible to the needs and making sure that it is enabling and incentivizing the right behavior, you know, rather than shutting down prematurely too many operations and things like that. And something else that's really striking me about what you've shared is how relative the concept of freedom is. So earlier in the conversation, Charles, you mentioned that in the States, whilst there are conversations around this, no one's questioning the principle. They're questioning the level. But because it is the way it is, it's a default mindset that people aren't interrogating as much. Whereas in the UK, since the principle doesn't exist, there's a whole different kind of layer of conversation. I just find that so interesting in terms of what we're used to, what we think of as normal, and therefore where our mindset is at and what we experience as freedom within that. So I think there's a lot of interesting lessons or just a nice mirroring of the UK mindset against these different backdrops. And so based on all of this very, very sensible advice, I'm sure anyone listening will agree that this sounds like a pretty damn good idea.
I'm not so sure. Maybe you could have them on next time.
So what is next? Right now, there's a lot of conversations. I know, Charles, you wrote that article, The Missing Billion. And Nicole, you're doing all this research. And Roger, you're such an incredible thought leader. And you're all really at the forefront of this conversation. And there's a lot happening around it. What do you hope happens next? What in a kind of in a macro way, but also the baby steps? What is next for the UK? What does success look like for you in the short and long term?
So it wouldn't surprise me if this does move onto the agenda of the Labour Party. Certainly not before an election, but afterwards, you know, they are looking at all sorts of desperately scrabbling for ways to find means of putting money into the social problems that they care about. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if this was something that they ended up looking at and exploring, and perhaps taking a slightly different approach to a Conservative government that would view this slightly differently. And I think it actually does come back to your point there about freedom. It's freedom with accountability, right? And there is something, I think, quite odd about our system in that actually these foundations, which have hundreds and hundreds of millions in assets, operate under the same rules as Cats Protection does, or, you know, the community library. And is that right? I think at that like conceptual level, yeah, you should probably ask yourself whether that's going to stay, you know, freedom with accountability.
That's a great point. And of course, yeah, looking at the US model where you have 501c3 private foundations and c3 public charities, there's very different regulatory regimes and pathways for them because they're treated as different. So regulatory reform might be one thing. And I think Nicole's right to point out about, you know, the hopes that many have on a range of issues for the Labour Party coming into government. But it was, after all, Lord Rooker, who was a Labour peer, who originally suggested a 1.5% payout, which went absolutely nowhere. And I fear, like some of the policies around private schools for the Labour Party, this might end up not going very far once lobbyists on the other side of the debate have their views. So I think, you know, there should be an arena for debate and more scrutiny. And I'd also, I think I'd like to see just more literacy about these figures, so that people can actually see what it is that foundations are spending relative to the size of their assets and how much is being spent on their investment managers as well. And we should know that. That's public interest information. But also, I would say on the positive side, and I would say this as the editor of a publication covering philanthropy, just actually the potential for philanthropy to do good with those resources and to showcase some of the impact it can have when it thinks purposefully about the use of resources and then is transparent and ethical in its approach. So I don't think it's all bad. I actually think my initial thinking about this topic comes from the point of view there's potential for philanthropy to do so much more and better. And that's why we really need to be a critical friend, if you like. It's what we try to be.
And I would definitely echo both of those. I guess in the sort of broader sense, what I hope is, however this conversation develops in the UK around foundation payout, it does so in a way where there's room for a bit of nuance, and it doesn't, like so many things in philanthropy, just kind of collapse into a really kind of binary, well, this is good or this is bad, and it's all very clear cut. I think hopefully what people have got from this conversation is, even if you think that there is a strong argument for a mandatory payout on, you know, requirement on foundations, there are also kind of legitimate concerns and things to take into account about the practicalities of it. And that's always the case with philanthropy. I mean, it's quite complicated because you're trying to sort of match together people's individual views and choices and freedoms with thinking about things at a sort of systemic level. And then I guess the final thing that I'd say is a plea really to the philanthropy sector itself, that in addressing these issues and facing up to them, it doesn't fall into the trap that I think often philanthropy does of looking like it's just pleading on the basis of self-interest. There's often a kind of response from philanthropy when, you know, tax incentives on donations are questioned or other things are, that it just looks like it's kind of pulling up the drawbridges and clamming up and arguing for the maintenance of the status quo just because it's the status quo. And I think coming back to, what are we all here to do? Why are we doing this stuff in the first place? And what is in the best interest of the people and communities that we're supposed to be serving? And then making decisions based on that rather than just on protecting what we currently have. That would look a lot better, I think.
So, Rodri, just one final question for you. If you were the culture secretary, what level of payout would you insist on for the philanthropy sector?
Yeah, I mean, I think for the reasons I said, I genuinely think the question about foundation legal form is more difficult than perhaps we've painted it here. I do think actually finding a way of specifying what organizations and institutions we're talking about is pretty difficult. But assume that we could solve that problem. I think starting from looking at whether, you know, with modeling a 5% payout, you know, whether there's any evidence that would have a hugely negative effect. And then, as you know, Nicole says, working back from there, maybe as the Canadians have done, and thinking, maybe we need to set our sights slightly lower. I think that would be a sensible kind of phased way of doing things.
Brilliant. What a fabulous, sensible note to end on. Thank you all so much for your time, for sitting down with us, for everything you're doing and the conversations you're having and writing about. I've personally learned so much from this conversation and from everything that you've done to date. So thank you. Thanks for sharing that. And with listeners, we really appreciate it.
Thanks for hosting us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in, and hope you loved the conversation with Charles, Rodri, and Nicole. A big thank you to them again.
As always, we at IG would love to connect with you. You can find us on LinkedIn as IG Advisors. Our website is impactandgrowth.com. And we also have a fellowship called the Fix the Flow Fellowship, which you can find out more about at fixtheflow.org.
And finally, another thank you to our official sponsor, Siegel Family Foundation, for making this possible. And to our media partner, led by Charles, Alliance Magazine. Don't forget, you can use the code WHATDONORSWANT, all one word, for 50% off of a subscription. Thanks again for listening. See you soon.
This podcast was produced by me, Rachel Stephenson-Sheff, and the team at Scrubcast. Shout out to Dave and Tim. Please rate, review, and subscribe if you can. It really helps us do what we do. Thanks so much.